Over to you.
Yep.
All yours.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I am Adrienne Landsteiner, and thank you for this opportunity to present the findings from our systematic review on screening for hepatocellular carcinoma in adults at increased risk. I'm a health services researcher with the Minneapolis VA Evidence Synthesis Program, and we provide systematic review services for VA leadership so that they may develop and implement evidence-based guidelines and policies. So a brief overview, the evidence synthesis of our evidence synthesis program. It was established in 2007 with the intention of providing systematic reviews for those developing policies and guidelines at the VA. The evidence synthesis program produces reports that are meant to help develop clinical policies informed by the evidence, implement effective services and support VA clinical practice guidelines and performance measures, and set the direction for future research to address gaps in clinical knowledge. There are 4 ESP centers led by VA clinicians and recognized leaders in the field of evidence synthesis, and the coordinating center for the program is located in Portland. Review topics are submitted to the coordinating center, and those proposals are then ranked and distributed among the 4 evidence review programs. So the 4 programs are located in Minneapolis, Providence, Durham, and LA. And as I stated before, we are the Minneapolis program. So on to our topic for today, screening for hepatocellular carcinoma in adults at increased risk. And just to make note, the full length report is available on the ESP website for those that are interested. So briefly, our disclosures, our Minneapolis Center is directed by Dr. Timothy Wilt and Dr. Denise Dewan Porter. We're funded by the VA HSR&D, and we have no financial involvements. For each of our reviews, we engage with and consult content experts, a technical expert panel, and our operational partners. Each of these individuals provide expertise in either the research area or review methodology, and we greatly appreciate their willingness to share their expertise. We would like to first acknowledge our operational partners, Dr. Timothy Morgan and Dr. Jason Dominitz, for nominating the topic and ushering it through the refinement process. And we appreciated Dr. Morgan and Dr. Dominant's responsiveness and willingness to discuss and review our findings. We'd also like to acknowledge and thank our technical expert panel members, Dr. Denatolis, Dr. Kelly, Dr. Califano, Dr. Kinsara, and Dr. Ioannou. So, getting to the topic, some background. In 2024, an estimated 41,630 Americans will be diagnosed with liver cancer, with 29,840 ultimately dying from the disease. HCC is the 6th most common cancer and of particular concern to the VA, as veterans have a 3- to 5-fold higher incidence of the disease when compared to the general population. A decline in the number of veterans receiving treatment for HCC has been noted, and it is hypothesized that the decline is driven primarily by a reduction in hepatitis C related HCC, but importantly, during the same period, the incidence of non-hepatitis C related HCC has increased. So here I show the results of the Surveillance Epidemiology and End Results Program, SEER, that show that age-adjusted rates of liver and intrahepatic bile duct cancer in the U.S. more than doubled between 1992 and 2012, before leveling off and slightly decreasing over the last decade. However, despite the slight drop in incidence, mortality has remained stable over the last 10 years. So early identification of HCC is important, particularly as early identification may reduce mortality by providing opportunities for curative therapies, which includes surgical resection, ablative therapy, or liver transplantation. And secondly, treatment for cirrhosis and HCC are costly for both the patient and the institution. So this review is in response to a request from the National Gastroenterology and Hepatology Program to evaluate the evidence regarding screening for hepatocellular carcinoma, HCC, and to identify benefits and harms of HCC screening among adults at increased risk. So to jump right in, I'm going to first present our key findings and then walk through how the review was conducted and how our conclusions were reached. So first, evidence is very uncertain regarding the effectiveness and harms of HCC screening in adults at increased risk. Second, evidence is generally very uncertain regarding comparative effects of different screening strategies, which including imaging modalities, intervals, and biomarkers. Third, most studies analyzed only individuals with an HCC diagnosis, thus missing the target increased risk population. And there are major methodological issues that limit certainty, including a combination of lead and length time bias, and little controlling for confounders known to affect the receipt of screening and survival. Fourth, the evidence gaps could be closed with completion of RCTs, specifically RCTs comparing screening with no screening, and higher methodological quality observational studies. Our suggestion is to consider the target trial emulation framework. And finally, until methodologically higher quality studies are completed, uncertainty makes evidence-based HCC screening implementation and patient-clinician decision-making challenging. So after giving you kind of the high-level conclusion of our review, kind of stepping back into how we reach those conclusions. So our key question, what are the benefits and harms of HCC screening in adults at increased risk? Do the benefits and harms vary by patient or coexisting medical characteristics? We included age, sex, race and ethnicity, and comorbidities. Do they vary by the presence of cirrhosis? Do they vary by liver disease etiology or the severity or HCC risk of the individual? Do they vary by screening intervals, whether semi-annual, annual, or biennial? And do they vary by screening modality with or without AFP, specifically ultrasound, MRI, and CT? So these are our eligibility criteria. The population of interest for the review were adults at increased risk for HCC, specifically those with cirrhosis or those with liver disease. And after lengthy conversations with our content experts, technical expert panels, and our operational partners, we also included those deemed to be at increased risk as defined by study authors. The interventions of interest were abdominal imaging or HCC screening with or without AFP. And our outcomes of interest were all-cause mortality, overall survival, HCC-specific mortality, receipt of curative intent, treatment, stage of diagnosis, and screening harms. We included all study designs, so RCTs, comparative experimental or observational studies. We did require that there be a comparator of either no screening or a different modality or schedule. And setting, we included everything except hospice. So in total, we screened approximately 4,984 articles, and through triage and full text review, we had a remaining 74 citations that were included in the review. So our protocol was developed in consultation with and approved by our partners and TEP members, and it was subsequently registered with Prospero before we began risk of bias and data extraction. Two previous reviews synthesizing the evidence of HCC screening among chronic liver disease populations had been previously published. The first was by Consagra and et al. In 2014, and the second was by Singal et al. In 2022. We updated the search by Singal using Embase and Medline, and then we then captured all the studies and trials that had been included in the two previous reviews and added the studies identified with the updated search. All of these studies, including those that were included in the two previous reviews, were put through abstract triage and full text review, along with the newly identified studies from the updated search. We used the Cochrane Risk of Bias 2 and the Robin's Eye tools to assess the risk of bias for all the included studies, and one team member extracted all the data with a second overreading the data. We then used GRADE to assess the certainty of evidence. So as the two previous reviews came to conflicting conclusions, and as our work is an update of these two previous reviews, I will walk through how those reviews and our current review compare on specific items of interest. All three reviews included observational study designs. However, both Consagra and Singal chose not to stratify the review findings by study design, and instead reported on all the studies as a whole. We chose to stratify by study design as methodology, both in design and analytic approach, are very different depending upon the type of study executed. And as you can see here, of the three reviews, only Cingal chose to pool the data with a meta-analysis. We agreed with Gonzaga that the degree of heterogeneity, which was likely due to the variation in study design and methodology, would not lend well to the meta-analysis. And I've circled here the I-squared from Cingal's meta-analysis, which demonstrates that there is a great deal of heterogeneity in the pooled analysis, and as such, one should be cautious that these studies may be too different from each other to be pooled. As our observational studies were included in all three reviews, we assessed whether review authors accounted for lead time bias. And lead time bias occurs when a disease is detected by screening at an earlier time point than it would have been if it had been diagnosed by its clinical appearance. If survival time is calculated from the point of disease detection, then the screening would falsely appear to have resulted in improved survival, when in reality, those patients lived the same amount of time after the point at which the disease would have been diagnosed by clinical symptoms. So Gonzaga and Cingal performed sensitivity analyses with a subset of studies that controlled for lead time bias. But considering the significant bias, we chose to require that studies would need to control for lead time bias to be included in our review. A second concern is length bias, which is where there is an overestimation of survival due to the relative excess of cases detected that are slow progressing, while fast progressing cases are detected after symptoms are present. So adjusting for length bias is difficult and few or no studies controlled for this bias. Gonzaga made note of this bias, Cingal did not mention it, and we addressed this concern in our discussion. Finally, as we included observational studies, careful assessment and inclusion of confounders by study authors was an important consideration when assessing risk of bias for this review. Gonzaga developed a list of important confounders, which included age, sex, and liver disease severity. And then we added to this list and included comorbidities, lead time, and liver disease etiology. Cingal did not list any confounders of concern. So the three reviews had similar populations, though Cingal was more restrictive than Gonzaga or our current review and only included patients with cirrhosis. All three defined a similar method of screening, and all three allowed for a comparator of no screening, though Gonzaga and our current review allowed for comparison of different modalities or schedules. All-cause and HCC-specific mortality were the primary outcomes for the Gonzaga review and our current review. The primary outcomes for Cingal were early stage detection, curative therapy, and all-cause survival. Finally, Gonzaga and our current review did not include abstracts or conference proceedings in the body of included evidence, and Cingal did allow inclusion of these publications. So the Gonzaga review and our current review included randomized controlled trials. The Cingal review did not, and we used an updated version of the risk of bias tool from Cochrane that was not available when Gonzaga was published. We used the Robin's Eye tool from Cochrane to assess the risk of bias for observational studies. It was also not available when Gonzaga was published, and they used two tools published by ARC for the EPC programs. Cingal cited the use of a National Institute of Health tool with modifications. However, they didn't specify what those modifications are, so I cannot note them for you. Finally, Gonzaga used GRADE to describe certainty of evidence for the RCTs, and Cingal did not assess a certainty of evidence. We also used GRADE, however, we used it for both the RCTs and the observational evidence. So a comparison of the review conclusions. After having stepped through the differences and similarities of the three reviews, Gonzaga finds very low strength evidence of the effects of HCC screening on mortality in patients with chronic liver disease. Cingal did not use GRADE to assess certainty, but states that there is an association between HCC surveillance and early detection, curative treatment receipt, and survival in patients with cirrhosis. And finally, our review found that evidence is very uncertain as to whether HCC screening in increased risk individuals reduces all-cause or HCC-specific mortality. So now I'm going to step through why we have such uncertainty in the evidence after conducting our review of the literature. So digging into the evidence a bit, as I mentioned earlier, we chose to stratify by study design a priori. And here I've included a brief table summarizing the study designs that were included. This is important because of the differences that we see in the observational study designs and methodology. So the randomized controlled trial is generally considered the gold standard in medical research and has a very standardized methodology. There is greater variation in the observational study designs. The case control and cohort study designs are traditional approaches in observational research, and the case control design assigns people to either case or control, depending on the outcome of interest and the exposure to the intervention. The cohort design can be prospective or retrospective in nature, and many make use of administrative or secondary data sets. In a cohort design, the population of interest is typically defined through a common condition or exposure and then followed over time to see if an outcome occurs. The final design that we have detailed here, we have coined and named the HCC cohort. Similar to the cohort study design, it is similar in nature to the cohort study design in that a population is followed over time. However, these studies capture a population that has already has the outcome of interest, which is the diagnosis of HCC. So it's in essence a case population. These individuals are then categorized as screened or not screened and then followed to see if and when they die. By including only those with a diagnosis of HCC, these authors have excluded an important set of the at-risk individuals that underwent screening but were not diagnosed with HCC, which precludes an accurate assessment and analysis of the harms. So as we saw in our flow diagram, the review included a total of 74 studies. 5 of those were RCTs. We had 2 case control studies. 5 were considered traditional cohort, but the vast majority of the available evidence, 62 studies, were these HCC cohorts. The studies varied in regards to the included populations, and authors had varied definitions of increased risk. There are also differences in screening strategies, the comparators, and the outcomes reported. All of these contribute to the large heterogeneity that exists when investigating the possibility of a meta-analysis and assessing the certainty of the evidence. So some study characteristics. To give you an idea of how these studies varied, as we noted previously, the majority of studies were the HCC cohort design. Only 20 of the 62 required a cirrhosis diagnosis. 7 of those studies were in a veteran population, and approximately 42% were conducted in Asian countries. Also of note, the vast majority of these studies were rated high or critical risk of bias, and I will cover that in more detail in upcoming slides. So the most frequently reported outcomes were overall survival, the percent that received curative therapy, and the HCC stage of diagnosis. Among the included studies that used secondary data sets, the electronic medical records were the most frequently used. All of these data sources have underlying structures that can lead to selection and/or misclassification biases. It is important that authors carefully consider how to combat or adjust for these biases when conducting these studies. And here we can see the variation in comparators used in the included studies. We have many where it's screening versus none, but that could be defined as either screening every 6 months or every 12 months, having a single ultrasound with AFP 5 years or 4 years prior to diagnosis. We then also have the multiple screening intervals versus none. We have 6 months versus some other defined interval versus none. And then we had changes in screening interval with three months versus 6 months. And then the other modalities. So we had ultrasound versus ultrasound alternating with CT, ultrasound with or without AFP, and then any imaging with or without AFP versus nothing. So as the vast majority of the evidence is from observational studies, there was a reliance on administrative and secondary data sets. With the reliance on these data sets, authors are restricted to the use of algorithms to create their intervention definitions. And as you can see, this leads to a lot of variation in how screening for HCC was defined by authors. So as I had noted previously, we identified 5 randomized controlled trials. 3 were assessed as high risk of bias using the ROB 2.0 tool by Cochrane, and unfortunately included the only 2 studies evaluating screening versus no screening. None of them were adequately designed or executed to address the effectiveness or comparative effectiveness and harms of screening, especially among individuals with cirrhosis. So the Risk of Bias 2 tool assesses bias in five domains: randomization, deviation from intended interventions, including adherence and assignment, missing outcome data, measurement of outcome, and selection of reported results. Here I show the Zhang study, which did rate high risk of bias with two other trials due to concerns raised in the domain bias due to deviations from the intended interventions, with particular concern around adherence to the intervention and the impact this would have on the outcome. Other domains eliciting concern varied across studies, but included the process of randomization, missing data, and selection of the reported results. The analytic approaches applied in these trials were also concerning, including not accounting for cluster randomization, and in some instances, not applying an intention to treat methodology or blinding of outcome assessment. All the high risk of bias studies were conducted outside of the US, and unlike most individuals at increased risk for HCC in the United States, most enrollees in the two screening versus no screening RCTs had hepatitis B and did not have cirrhosis. The remaining two trials that were rated some concerns for risk of bias only had HCC-specific mortality as a common outcome, and both of them were comparative effectiveness. So our two case control studies. Both studies were rated as low risk of bias using the Robin's Eye tool developed by Cochrane. The study authors matched cases and controls on age, sex, year of diagnosis, race and ethnicity, severity, and severity of disease. And an advantage of the case control study design is the ability to control for confounding factors, including lead and length bias, and allows one to use a control group in the target population. Here I show the Moon study, which included a population of individuals with cirrhosis, while the Su et al. Study included those with hepatitis B. We considered both populations to be at increased risk and grouped them together when completing our grade assessments. For HCC-specific mortality, Moon reported a non-significant odds ratio for ultrasound plus AFP compared with no screening among individuals with cirrhosis. While in contrast, Su et al. Reported a significant odds ratio in favor of ultrasound screening with or without AFP versus no screening among a population of individuals with hepatitis B. And our cohort studies. So as I've mentioned, we identified six cohort studies. Using the Robin's Eye tool, we assessed risk of bias, and of those six studies, five of them were rated as critical risk of bias, primarily because they did not control for confounders of concern that we had identified a priori. So all of the studies that were rated as high risk of bias were missing multiple of these confounders, not just a single confounder, but often did include lead time bias. The major challenges to cohort studies are lead time and length time biases, and another major bias concerns patient and coexisting disease confounders known to affect screening, receipt, and survival, including comorbidities, liver disease, severity, or etiology, or leading to selection bias. Decision-making surrounding classification of intervention groups and outcomes was commonly omitted from these articles. So the single study by Kim et al. Seen here was rated as some concerns, and it evaluated ultrasound every 6 months versus ultrasound alternating with CT every 6 months. Authors reported an improved 10-year all-cause mortality among those alternating ultrasound with CT. However, this really only answers the question of comparative effectiveness, not effectiveness. We don't know if either the intervention or comparator are better than no surveillance. So the HCC cohorts. The HCC cohorts were our most frequently captured study design. The study design is problematic for a number of reasons. The first is the population selected for inclusion, designing the studies by including those already diagnosed with HCC misses the population of interest to the question. These individuals are no longer at-risk individuals. By including only individuals with HCC, one cannot accurately assess screening benefits and harms in the at-risk population, no matter the number of adjustments that one makes to a model. Secondly, the use of these study designs necessitates careful consideration of confounders and how to control for them. As mentioned previously, when assessing risk of bias for observational studies, we use the Robin's Eye tool. And as with the cohort studies, the same requirement for adjustment of analyses by a set of identified confounders for the study to be considered not critical risk of bias had to be met. Of this identified 62 HCC cohort studies, only 11 had incorporated these factors into their analytic approach. The remaining 51 studies were assessed as critical, as they did not control for these identified confounders. And as I noted previously with our cohort studies, similarly with the HCC cohort studies, they did not control for a number of the confounders, not just a single confounder. Oftentimes, lead bias was included in the list of confounders not controlled for. So here I present the HCC cohort studies that compared screening to no screening. The most commonly reported outcomes were overall mortality and survival, with a few studies reporting on stage at diagnosis. So a summary of these HCC cohorts where any imaging versus no screening was captured. There were 9 HCC cohort studies that investigated outcomes of individuals with HCC who had undergone screening using imaging compared to no imaging. We then had 2 studies comparing those with HCC who had undergone routine screening to no screening and irregular screening. And a 3rd study compared those with HCC who had undergone routine screening with 2 non-screening arms, those who had HCC detected symptomatically and those who had HCC detected incidentally. We had 2 studies comparing the effects of routine screening between 1 and 6 months with other screening intervals between 7 and 12 months, between 13 and 24 months, and between 25 and 36 months, in addition to a comparison with no screening. Our studies varied widely in sample size, ranging from as small as 333 to almost 65,000. A variety of liver disease etiologies, from cirrhosis, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, alcohol-related disease, and variations in follow-up, from 17 months to 8 years. Among those studies, 6 studies reported statistically significant reductions in all-cause mortality when comparing screening with no screening, and their hazard ratios ranged from 0.51 to 0.79. 4 of the studies reporting all-cause mortality also included arms which compared the effect of routine versus irregular screening, and 5 studies of imaging versus no imaging, and 2 studies of routine screening with irregular screening also reported overall survival. Authors reported significantly longer survival for individuals with HCC who had received screening using imaging when compared to those who had not undergone screening. So the certainty of the evidence. So here I'm presenting the certainty of the evidence for the outcomes reported when screening was compared to no screening. We did complete grade assessments on the other reported outcomes by the different screening modalities and timing. However, it's quite lengthy and can be a bit overwhelming. So I will direct you to the full report if you want to review all of our certainty of evidence statements. The 2 included RCTs compared different screening intervals, so they are not included in this table, as this is surveillance versus no surveillance. So we used GRADE to assess the certainty of evidence. GRADE has 5 domains that one assesses to come to an overall certainty of evidence statement. They include risk of bias, imprecision, inconsistency, indirectness, and publication bias. For all 3 outcomes, all-cause mortality, HCC-specific mortality, and overall survival, we rated the evidence as very low. The outcomes that were reported by HCC cohorts, we rated down for risk of bias, imprecision, and indirectness. And for the case control studies, we rated down for imprecision and inconsistency. So after walking through the available evidence and process, we circle back to the conclusions reached by the 3 reviews. Consagra and our current review both found that the evidence to be of very low certainty or uncertain. Singal reported an association, but did not assess the certainty of the evidence. These conclusions are driven in large part by our concerns regarding the HCC cohort study design and its inherent limitations. So as I stated, the overarching theme is the evidence is very uncertain when it comes to assessing the effectiveness of screening for HCC in adults at increased risk. The use of those diagnosed with HCC as the at-risk population, as well as study designs that do not control for lead and length bias, hinders the ability to form recommendations or guidelines. A major issue is the combination of lead time bias and length time bias, and another major concern is patient and coexisting disease confounders that are known to affect both receipt of screening and survival, such as comorbidities and liver disease severity and etiology. I should mention there are some limitations to our review. We are limited to the English language. So everything, all of the included articles were in English, and we're unable to assess harms or costs associated with screening, as neither were reported in the included studies. Suggestions for future research include capturing a truly at-risk population, capture of the screening harms and costs, and consideration of a target trial emulation framework. Here's a list of some studies that are currently underway that will hopefully be publishing their findings in the future and provide methodologically rigorous evidence. So in conclusion, the evidence is very uncertain, in large part due to methodological concerns, and until we have higher quality studies, it will be a challenge to those developing screening guidance. And so at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Wilt for some very short discussion before we turn it over to Dr. Iwanu.
Thanks so much, Adrian. Really nice overview of things. I just put these three main study design exemplars up here to kind of reiterate what we found, but I want to just go back briefly to how this report was originated. I really want to thank Tim Morgan and Jason Dominitz and our TEP members for nominating this one. When we asked them, why do you want this review? They said, well, we're looking for evidence that can inform clinical practice and policy. And when I asked, what about the existing review or the prior review from Dr. Consagra done by the VA? And we were told, well, there's a whole lot of new research that we feel makes that review essentially obsolete. We looked really closely and we found a whole lot of research. But as I think Adrian highlighted, unfortunately, that research almost always misses the target of what we're looking for. That is, what is the effect and comparative effectiveness of screening in at-risk individuals? They use these HCC cohort designs. Dr. Landsmeyer talked about the challenges and problems with the RCT by Zhang, in particular with hepatitis B. The study that George was involved with was actually done in veterans and found no difference in those with cirrhosis. And they had a really nice discussion about what they looked for with that. But if our target population is those with cirrhosis, the best data we have to date is probably that screening doesn't work in those individuals. And then these series of HCC cohorts, and one was just recently published that we'll just describe. So we made some calls for future research. What can happen in the interim? You know, ideally, we'd have a randomized control trial of screening versus no screening. My past career, my career has been involved with cancer detection and prevention. I've served on numerous clinical guideline committees, including the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force and the American College of Physicians. And the data we've seen in HCC screening is really, unfortunately, some of the weakest methodologically that we've seen. And there's good evidence from prior studies that results from observational studies, for example, in ovarian cancer screening, don't always translate out when looked at in randomized control trials. So what would be my suggestions? First and foremost, do better research that really gets at the problem. Two, as George is going to highlight, enroll people in his VA cooperative study. I may have some quibbles about it, but it's a darn good study that's going to get us some answers. That target trial emulation study or some other good cohort studies could get us closer to it. Don't keep attempting these HCC cohort studies. They do not address the question. And what would I do in practice and policy in the interim? We've got to act in the meantime. We don't say that screening does not work. We say it's uncertain, and certainly some of the harms due to biopsies, et cetera, have been reduced due to MRIs. But I think what we could do is probably do a better job at discussing with patients the uncertainty about it. Also that, along with our clinicians, align policy and recommendations more in line with the evidence rather than a strong recommendation that screening works, acknowledge the uncertainty with that with our patients, and then enroll individuals in screening programs that are at your medical center that are much more in line with, let's say, what George is going to be describing, those at greatest risk of getting HCC, but also most likely to benefit and don't have severe comorbidities, including advanced cirrhosis. I think if we do that, we can move from the literature of uncertainty, but also try and implement practice in that uncertainty that attempts to maximize the benefit while minimizing the harms, including limited enrollment in screening programs and ways to exit them out of it if they've had sufficiently been screened for a long time, of which, by the way, ultrasound is one of the most intensive screening programs every 6 months for cancer. And if they've had multiple screening rounds and are negative, and maybe they're getting older or sicker, maybe they could be informed that additional screening might not be necessary. Next slide real quick, just to finish it up. So the study recently published in JAMA Network Open, I'm sure many of you have seen it. I think they've done an attempt to improve the design of these HCC cohort studies. We subsequently sent a comment to them. I encourage you to read our response. Again, despite their attempts, there are considerable methodological limitations. And as Dr. Landsteiner showed, this design cannot adequately address the question at hand about screening effectiveness and harms in at-risk populations. Thanks so much. And George, turn it over to you.
Okay, thanks, Tim. Thanks, Adrian, for this opportunity to present. My name is George Ioannou. I'm the Director of Hepatology at the Veterans Affairs Puget Sound Healthcare System. And I'm also presenting, I guess, as a chair of the Liver Cancer Field Advisory Board of the National GI Hepatology Program Office. And I'm going to give you, I think, the perspective maybe of hepatologists around the country and maybe more so GI and hepatology within the VA on liver cancer screening in the light of this new ESP meta-analysis and review that was so meticulously done by Tim Wilt and his group. I wanted to start by highlighting what I think are three really important epidemiological and clinical facts about liver cancer that influence the way we approach liver cancer screening. The first is that the at-risk population for liver cancer is very small. Something like 80 or 85% of all liver cancers occur in patients who have cirrhosis or those who have hepatitis B. Unfortunately for us, this proportion may be declining, but let's say that that's approximately correct. That means we only have to screen a tiny subset of the population to identify the majority of liver cancers. Maybe the population in the United States who have cirrhosis or hepatitis B is something like 1 or 2 or 3% or 4%. Those are the people that people are advocating screening, very different from, say, screening from colorectal cancer, where you have to screen everyone over age 45, for example. The second fact is a corollary of the first one is, yes, we have to screen a small proportion, but among those at risk, the risk of liver cancer is actually extremely high. This has been shown many times among patients with cirrhosis, for example, the annual risk of liver cancer is about 1 to 5% per year. And this is unique among major malignancies, among populations who are getting screened. For example, for colorectal cancer, among the population that's getting screened, the lifetime risk is 1.5%. And maybe the risk, annual risk of colorectal cancer is something like 1% or less than 1%. But for patients with cirrhosis, every year they have a risk of 1 or 2 or 3 or 5% every year of getting liver cancer. So you can even think of cirrhosis as a pre-malignant condition itself, and that tendency to malignancy is compounded by the additional carcinogenic effects of viruses like hepatitis C and hepatitis B for those who have those conditions, and even alcohol itself for those who have alcohol-associated liver disease. On top of that, the case fatality of liver cancer is still very high, about 50%. So if you consider a very high absolute risk of getting liver cancer, and in addition, a high risk of mortality, you end up with a very high absolute risk of death from liver cancer in patients with cirrhosis, which essentially what that means is that the number needed to screen to prevent one liver cancer is actually very small, provided, of course, we have a screening test that's effective for reducing cancer-related mortality. We estimated in a study that's for for power calculations in the study of relative effectiveness that we only needed to screen 40 people with a more effective screening modality than a less effective screening modality to prevent one liver cancer death. These are things that we have going for us in terms of liver cancer screening. The third clinical fact that I wanted to bring up, I didn't know exactly who the audience were, but I think there is a misconception out there that treatments for liver cancer are ineffective. I don't think that's true anymore. We have made huge progress in terms of treatments for liver cancer. So from 1995 to 2024, we have made almost no progress in terms of liver cancer screening, the same strategies that were advocated 30 years ago are more or less being advocated now, but we have made huge progress in terms of liver cancer screening. We have many modalities that when liver cancer is detected early can be considered curative, including surgical resection, liver transplantation, and I think most importantly in my mind, percutaneous ablative techniques that are very relatively inexpensive, low morbidity procedures, same day procedures that can cure a small malignancy. And we have many other local regional treatments and even systemic therapies that may not necessarily cure treat a malignancy, but have been shown to improve mortality. So the main deficit we have in liver cancer care is actually in the realm of screening and early detection. So what do the national societies, liver societies recommend? The American Association for the Study of the Liver Diseases, which is our United States Liver Society, recommends screening in patients with cirrhosis and in those with hepatitis B with an ultrasound and alpha-fetoprotein every 6 months. And I want to point out to you that that actually is considered a fairly conservative recommendation by liver society standards, because the European Society, which is called ESOL, actually recommends screening in those with advanced fibrosis and cirrhosis. And the Asia-Pacific Association, it's called APASL, even recommends screening in those who even have earlier stage of fibrosis, stage 0 to 2, if they have hepatitis C, as well as those with stage 3 fibrosis and stage 4 fibrosis, which is the same as saying cirrhosis. But the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, as Tim alluded, makes no recommendation for liver cancer screening. And it's important to highlight that. I think sometimes in hepatology, we're living in a bubble because we recommend that and our own liver societies recommend that. It's important to point out that overarching organizations that deal with cancer screening in general do not make a recommendation for liver cancer screening. And in fact, even the NCI doesn't make a recommendation for liver cancer screening. And the reason for that is because of the data that Adrienne reported and Tim reported in their evidence synthesis program and reconfirmed, that there's no evidence that HCC screening with ultrasound plus AFP reduces liver cancer-related mortality in patients with cirrhosis. And it's important to recognize that this is the kind of evidence we need in order to, for societies like the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force to make a recommendation. They need evidence to demonstrate that screening reduces liver cancer-related mortality, not that just screening improves early detection or surrogate endpoints, but that it improves liver cancer-related mortality. But I also wanted to emphasize, when we say that there's no evidence that HCC screening reduces cancer-related mortality, what we mean is that we don't have appropriate RCTs to demonstrate that that screening reduces cancer-related mortality. Just that these studies have not been done. We're not saying that we have evidence that RCTs have been done and we have found out that screening is not effective. So these are two very different things. I know it's almost self-evident to say that, but it's important to say, yes, we acknowledge there is no evidence that HCC screening reduces liver cancer-related mortality. And that is because appropriate studies have not been done, not necessarily because studies have been done and demonstrated the lack of effectiveness of screening. So we currently have, I guess, a classic stalemate in liver cancer screening. We have no high quality evidence, as reconfirmed by Adrienne's systematic review and evidence synthesis analysis. We have no evidence that screening reduces mortality, no high quality evidence. However, at the same time, screening has become the de facto standard of care, at least in hepatology and in many primary care settings, which makes it virtually impossible for us to perform a randomized control trial or screening versus no screening. So how do we break out of this stalemate We cannot do randomized controlled trials of screening versus no screening, but we can potentially do randomized controlled trials of screening with a new, what we think is a more effective modality versus the current standard of care, the ultrasound plus AFP, which might be considered of low effectiveness or even maybe no effectiveness. And the idea is if those studies would be palatable and can be done, and patients would enroll, and IRBs would have no objections, and hepatologists and primary care providers would have no objections. And even purists would agree that if we demonstrate that a new screening test reduces cancer-related mortality relative to the current standard of care, that would prove that screening reduces cancer-related mortality, because the only other alternative would be that the ultrasound and AFP actually increases cancer-related mortality, and nobody really postulates that. And the good news is that there are at least two such studies ongoing right now. One is the study that the VA is conducting, and I'm co-chairing with Dr. Tuddy in West Haven. It's called the Premium Study, and it's a study of abbreviated MRI plus alpha-fetoprotein versus ultrasound plus alpha-fetoprotein in patients with cirrhosis at high risk of liver cancer. And another study is conducted by the NCI, is called the TRACER study, and it's a study of a biomarker panel called GALAD versus ultrasound plus alpha-fetoprotein. And actually, this study is initially designed to show differences in early detection of liver cancer by year two or three, but in their protocol, they say that if they do show improvements in early detection by year two or three, they're committed to continue the study and expand it in order to be powered to show differences in liver cancer-related mortality. So we might have, now don't hold your breath, these studies are going to take years, but at least they're happening. After 30 years, they're finally happening. Adrian and team brought up the issue of target trial emulations, and I've had the luck and the privilege in the last 3 or 4 years to gain a bit of expertise in target trial emulations in the therapeutic realm. And I actually don't think there's hardly any target trial emulations of screening studies. Maybe there's one for colorectal cancer screening. But I think that's a brilliant idea. And that, you know, I don't know that target trial emulations or any, which is still an observational design, will ever convince people that this is, that there's evidence, high quality one way or another, but this definitely would be a much, much better study design compared to the ones that Adrienne so carefully criticized in her presentation. So for the time being, what do we do? This is an email that went out by the National GI Hepatology Program Office by Dr. Tim Morgan right after the ESP results were made public, which read that the VA National Gastroenterology and Hepatology Program Office recommends that providers discuss HCC screening with their patients with cirrhosis as part of shared decision-making, and that many hepatology providers plan on recommending screening with abdominal ultrasound scans and serum AFP testing every 6 months, as recommended by the American Association for the Study of Liver Diseases. And I want to say that more or less that's kind of what we do right now. So it's not like every patient with cirrhosis is getting screening indiscriminately. I think shared decision-making is happening. I think a lot of thought is put into screening, and the kind of screening compliance that we have consistently in the VA is about 50%. So at one time screening. So this is, if you look at patients who are noted in the ALD, advanced liver disease dashboard, as having cirrhosis at one time point, and you identify how many of them have had an ultrasound or contrast-enhanced CT or MRI in the last 6 months, about 50% will fulfill those criteria. You're not even asking about do they have an additional alpha-fetoprotein. The VA has been tracking these numbers through the GI hepatology programs for years. We moved the needle a little bit, but we're stuck at around 50, 51, 55%. We went down during the pandemic, went up a little bit. And the reason it's only 50% is because not everybody necessarily has cirrhosis. Some people who have cirrhosis have advanced cirrhosis and shouldn't be getting screening. Some of them have comorbidities and shouldn't be getting screening. Some of them don't want to get screening. So I think thought appropriately goes into this as part of shared decision-making. And we try to be very thoughtful about recommending liver cancer screening working in the setting of uncertain data and very, you know, necessarily low quality data. So thank you very much. I was going to stop here. I think that's kind of my perspective, more or less. And maybe I would say that the GI Hepatology Program Office, to a certain extent, as perspective, but I'm sure there may be a lot of discussion and a lot of varying opinions about this. Thanks very much, Tim and Adrienne, and for this opportunity to present today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm going to monitor the Q&A. I don't see any right now, but George, if I could first thank you so much. I agree that target trial emulation is not a randomized trial, but if I were going to request where VAHSR or whoever would or others would put their money and effort, it would be to go that route rather than more of these HCC cohort studies, which we've seen just so many of. Do you have any idea of what the competing mortality is in patients with cirrhosis? And I know your trial has suggested some criteria for who would be eligible, i.e. their risk of developing cancer and their risk of comorbidities leading to other cause of death, because those are the two kind of competing issues that clinicians have to think about. Are you at higher risk, high enough risk to get cancer, but low enough risk from dying of something else?
Yeah, so there's two ways to address that. One is the liver-related mortality. So we only screen patients who have CHAS A or B cirrhosis. We don't screen patients who have CHAS C cirrhosis. CHAS A and B means CHAD, TURCOP, Hugh score 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. And you have to calculate it. I don't think you kind of, well, I think it's kind of a CHAS A or B. And so we have to abide by that, because patients with more advanced liver disease, as you rightly pointed out, truly have a very high non-liver cancer-related mortality and probably don't stand to benefit from screening. And then there is the non-liver-related mortality. So especially in veterans, those with cirrhosis have a lot of other comorbidities. And this is becoming more and more a problem, because now cirrhosis is dominated by what we now call MASLD, metabolic dysfunction associated steatotic liver disease. MASLD cirrhosis, not hepatitis C cirrhosis. And these patients with MASLD cirrhosis are older and they have a lot of comorbidities like cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and so on and so forth. Because our study is a study, we have an objective way of calculating other non-liver related mortality. We use something called a cirrhosis comorbidity score, or CIRCOM, that was developed specifically to estimate non-liver-related mortality in patients with cirrhosis. But essentially, it means you have to have at least a life expectancy of 5 years or more unrelated to your liver in order to participate in the study. And I think that's kind of a good rule of thumb for anyone entering a liver cancer screening program. I mean, if a patient has life-threatening cardiovascular disease, other cancers, pulmonary disease, and so on, they're really not going to benefit from liver cancer screening.
Thanks so much. And so then a 5-year overall mortality, you know, median 5 years, that would be about a 5% risk of having liver cancer death. Good. Looks like we've got the Q&A kind of, and then I would just maybe come back to the, given what we're talking about with the VA, and I really like that suggestion, and where we're at 50%, that's where maybe the AASLD or other societies might move away from a, quote, strong recommendation, essentially that all patients should be screened with those criteria, to a more conditional or weak or some other suggestion that seems to be more in keeping with both what I would say the science and what it seems like VA is suggesting, what we're seeing, as you say, about thoughtful use of screening. But here's a question that I'm going to read out. I think it's for George. Has there been thought regarding the rise in patients diagnosed with fatty liver? Do we expect screening guidelines for HCC change with this population, recognizing that we just discussed the uncertainty about even those at highest risk?
George? Well, I don't know. Beth, I think that's a very good question. I don't know if the guidelines are going to change, but here is the factors that are at play here. Number one, if you have MASLD, and your liver is still somewhat steatotic despite having cirrhosis, then the visualization score of ultrasound is worse. So ultrasound becomes an even worse screening tool the more patients we have with MASLD, and maybe even some of the data that we have that are from the hepatitis C era may not even apply. Now, not many people know that, but probably the same applies for alpha-fetoprotein. Alpha-fetoprotein, for reasons I don't have time to go into, but alpha-fetoprotein probably also performs a little bit worse in these patients with MASLD cirrhosis than it did in the patients with predominantly hepatitis C-related cirrhosis that drove most of the data that described the performance characteristics of alpha-fetoprotein. So in my mind, those are the two important considerations, like what are the performance characteristics of the screening test that we even recommend in this population of new population that we're going to have of MASLD-related cirrhosis. That's number one. And number two is the competing comorbidities that I mentioned earlier and the older age. So these patients tend to be much older. I mean, the average age of a MASLD cirrhosis patient in the VA is well into their 60s, if not 70s. So comorbidities, life expectancy play a big part.
Thank you. You got a nice shout out for your presentation. The bar for de-implementing standard of care is much higher than that for adding new evidence-based practice. Okay. If the VA is the only healthcare system not doing screening, we're going to violate the trust of veterans by not offering standard of care. I'm going to take just a quick shot at that, and then what George or Adrian chime in. I think there's a difference in, quote, standard of care, what somebody tells you you should do, and what the science shows. And I think what George kind of highlighted, and Dr. Landsteiner as well, is that the science is not real solid that screening works, nor do we have great science that it does not work. That's why we can talk with our patients, and that there would patients in the absence of solid evidence, what can one do? Does that mean we have to screen everyone for that or implement care for that? I think George's discussion about how to more carefully think it through, do the studies that are necessary. Our job is to improve the health of our patients and be honest with them about what we know about the science. George, you want to take that comment?
Well, I mean, it's a tough one. I don't think we're going to be the healthcare system not doing screening. I hope not. I just hope we continue to be very thoughtful about it. I think the way what I see about the ESP analysis that was just done is, again, reiterating, we don't have high quality evidence to support that screening reduces cancer-related mortality. What the VA then chooses to do with this is a different story. I mean, there's many areas of science, medicine that we don't have evidence for, but we still have to make a decision. And I'm not saying, you know, that you can always make a decision to do something or not to do something. It's not the same thing. There are implications. But we're not unique in this respect. I mean, I would argue that 90% of decisions we make on a daily basis, we make them in the absence of high-quality data supporting those decisions. We still have to make a decision. I hope that the VA continues to thoughtfully screen eligible patients with cirrhosis and hepatitis B. And I hope we also continue to be at the forefront of clinical research to actually eventually get to the bottom of this and what's the best screening test and how to best implement screening strategies to reduce cancer-related mortality.
That was really nicely said. We're getting to the top of the hour. Rob, do you have any suggestions to sign us off? Or
I do, yes. Thank you. Thank all three of you for your work in the VA and for preparing and presenting today and for doing this ESP investigation. Attendees, when I close the webinar, you'll be presented with a short survey. Please do take a few moments and provide answers to those questions. If you guys want to make closing comments, that's okay. We can go over by a minute or so. But if you don't want to, just let me know and I'll close.
Adrian?
Thank you, everyone.
I agree. This is really a nice presentation. We're really thoughtful people on all ends and nice questions. Thanks for your attendance. Thanks,
Docs.